Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Will the waters of the Everglades flow sweet and clear again? A controversial deal to force the sugar industry to clean up its act could dissolve. However, the Interior Department says this is the way environmental protection will flow in the future. Also this time, crops to harvest in the snow. Fall gardening with Larry Somke. And Biosphere 2 gets ready to break the seal after 2 years. Linda Lay looks back.
I can say that it's been, well, for me, it's certainly been stressful. And it's been 2 years under glass, separated from a whole lot of other friends and family, and that's very difficult.
These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt calls it, quote, the most ambitious ecosystem restoration project in history, end quote. $400 million will be spent to clean up the Florida Everglades, heavily polluted by phosphorus from the agricultural industry and urban runoff. The price tag for the cleanup was agreed to by representatives of the state's sugar industry, the state government, and the Federal Department of Interior to settle a lawsuit over liability for the pollution. Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks at the Department of Interior, George Frampton, says the settlement successfully ends years of litigation that might have gone on for many more years.
In the settlement, the industry is going to pay no less than $230 million, no more than $320 million over a period of 20 years, and in addition, provide substantially increased reductions of phosphorus through on-farm practices over and above those already agreed to in the federal court consent decree. So the alternative here is really 5 or 7 or 9 more years of litigation, with the prospect that even if the state and federal government succeeded and won the litigation, it would get less than it would by settling on these terms. And if we litigated, of course, year after year, the phosphorus would continue to flow into the Everglades system, and we'd continue to spend money on lawyers and experts rather than on cleaning up the system.
Tom Martin, executive director of the National Audubon Society's Everglades Restoration Campaign, says the settlement not only leaves a lot to be desired, on many fronts it falls way short of providing even the basics for cleanup and restoration.
The problems with the agreement are twofold. One, it never provides clean water for the Everglades. Never. Secondly, it has an inherently unfair distribution of costs. The fair share for cleanup of the agricultural pollution coming out of the Everglades agricultural area back to those farmers is about $307 million. They are paying less than a third of that. Less than a third. We don't think that kind of public subsidy is justified.
Martin says the agreement focuses entirely too much on the amount of money to be spent, missing what he sees as the real issue.
What the deal consists of is basically an agreement to cap the liability for the sugar interests for their pollution of the Everglades. It consists of little more than that, and that's part of the problem with it. It never tells us how we're going to achieve clean water in the Everglades. Never tells us how we're going to have an enforceable agreement. It never tells us how we are going to provide all the hydroperiod restoration water that was promised earlier. It never tells us how that water would be cleaned up. So all of those things are not in the agreement. Some are mentioned in passing. But frankly, the only thing that appears to be settled is between the federal, state, and governments and some of the sugar companies is how the maximum amount of money that those sugar companies have to pay.
Robert Bucher is vice president of U.S. Sugar Corporation, an agricultural industry employing 5,000 on the shores of Lake Okeechobee in the Everglades.
For farmers, we don't like it, but we can live with it. We have to pay a lot of money for a government restoration plan. And we're required to do very large reductions on our own property in addition to that. But if we're able to achieve environmental peace with these payments and reductions, then we will be satisfied, even though we're not happy.
What does specifically is it that you are not happy with in the settlement?
Well, the amount of money we're paying is more than we think is fair by a long shot. Secondly, we're not sure we can make the reductions on our own property that they've asked for because they're very large and we have to pay penalties if we don't.
In its natural state, the Everglades is a water and land system very poor in phosphorus. It supports an array of plants not needing a rich phosphorus source. However, with the growth of urban centers and the sugar industry's increased use of chemical fertilizers containing phosphorus, the soil and the water have changed in composition. A proposal offered in 1991 called for reducing the phosphorus count to 50 parts per billion by 1997, then down to 10 parts per billion by 2004. The settlement reached recently pushes up the first stage to 2004 and does not set a final stage. This is where most environmental organizers disagree with the settlement. However, Bucher says the reductions not only are enough, they are too much.
The standard that's set is twice as clean as rain. It's so clean that if you took a bottle of bottled water, like Evian, which is cleaner than drinking water, and poured it out in the park, you'd be violating the standard. These are very, very tough standards. You're getting below rainfall levels, below drinking water levels, below bottled water levels.
If there is so much of this agreement the environmental community dislikes, why did they agree to settle in this way? Tom Martin.
Well, we didn't agree. We were excluded from the discussions by Secretary Frampton, by the sugar community. They said, we don't want those people in the room. None of the environmental community was invited in, and the Miccosukee tribe, who's a party, wasn't invited in, and many sugar interests weren't invited in.
Bob Bucher.
Well, when he says that he wasn't at the table, the development of the plan, the what we're building, the standards, the cleanup methodologies, the restoration projects, he had a personal representative at the table for 3 months of meetings on that subject, and his representative agreed to the what we're building and where we're building it. The only thing that he was not asked to participate in was the funding discussions, and that's because he didn't bring a checkbook to the table.
A final agreement has not been reached on this matter. What has happened only is that some of the parties have agreed to agree in later discussions. There are many issues to confront, including just how much water the sugar industry is going to clean up and what they will do with that water once it is processed. Who else will share in the costs and with how much? And what else besides phosphorus will be treated? George Frampton is Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks at the Department of Interior. Tom Martin is director of the National Audubon Society's Everglades Restoration Campaign. Robert Bucher is vice president of employee-owned U.S. Sugar Corporation. This is Bruce Robertson. According to Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, most of us use only half our garden space. We plant our vegetables once in the spring and patiently await harvest by mid to late summer. That's fine, he says, but there is another way. Under a blazing summer sun, we find Larry out in the backfield garden working under a full head of steam.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Hey, Bruce, what's going on?
What are you doing?
Well, I'm doing a little tilling here because I'm planting my fall garden. A lot of people think that the only time that they can really plant fruits and vegetables and herbs in their garden is in the early spring. But now, late August, early September in some parts of the country is the very best time to plant some of the vegetables like these. Let me show you what I'm going to put in today. See, I've got Chinese cabbage. This is fennel. I'm going to put in some more dill. I got some more Chinese parsley. And this is roquette, which is a very cool gourmet herb now, also known as arugula. I've got some tatsoi, I've got broccoletti di rape, basically, I have a lot of members of the cabbage family. And now's a good time to put in Brussels sprouts, broccoli, kohlrabi, things like that, because they'll sprout now and get growing now during the warm weather. And then when it cools off, that really encourages them to grow. And really, I will have vegetables, Chinese vegetables, all the way up till Christmas.
But what about frost? I mean, isn't that something you've got to consider when you're planting now, that things will be coming into fruit when the frosts are hitting?
Yeah, you wouldn't want to plant zucchini or things like that or tomatoes that would be damaged by frost in the northern climates. But you can definitely put in things like these different types of cabbages and turnips that the frost doesn't bother them at all. They will stay fresh and edible all the way up till really hard, cold weather. They'll even take a little snow. They don't mind a little snow.
So what are you doing here to prepare the garden bed itself? The same thing you'd be doing in a spring plant?
Yeah, only this time, this is an area of my garden where I had my lettuce crop earlier this year. Now, of course, it's hot and summery. Now the lettuce is gone. So I'm rototilled into the ground all of the mulch that I used on the old lettuce crop. And now that's going to further enrich the soil. That's some more organic matter. I've put down some fertilizer here. I've got some natural organic fertilizer in my bucket. And I spread that out. Just toss it out in there. And then I till that in. And then after it's tilled, it's about as simple as you can get. You just, rake it out real nice and smooth. Just, create a nice little seed bed there. And then turn the rake upside down, draw a little line through there, and put the seeds in.
And that becomes your seed bed.
And also you probably notice this is my ideal size seed bed if you want to have a beautiful, easy garden, about 4 feet wide and about 10 feet long. That you can see, that's a nice big garden. I'm going to have bushel after bushel of produce out of it. So one of the keys to be an environmental gardener is keep your garden small. So you don't have to start using herbicides. Also, like I told you before, this was my lettuce garden. Now I'm planting cabbage. You never want to plant the same vegetable in the same place year after year, because pretty soon the diseases are going to get on them. The bugs are going to find them. So
they figure out where the best plant is each year.
What you want to do is fool them, make it difficult for them. In agriculture, they call it crop rotation. And for you, the backyard gardener, you just call it smart environmental gardening.
So fall gardening, fall planting is really sort of taking over from the first generation of garden to lead into the second generation.
Yeah, there used to be a saying, Harry Truman, an old-time New Englanders, would always say, wet or dry, plant peas or turnips on the 25th of July. So I've missed that date by a week or so, but still nice warm weather here in August, a good time to put in a garden that'll last all the way through Thanksgiving.
Well, unfortunately, as in the springtime, it's not so hot. It's not too bad working out in the garden. But right now, it's pretty hot out here, but let you get back to your rototilling.
Yeah, I will.
Start her up.
I'm looking forward to this because later on in the season, I'll be able to bring you some cabbages.
I'm looking forward.
Snowy outside,
I'm looking forward to it, too.
All right, let me see if I can get this thing going now.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His fall garden will be located near his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. During the 2 years they have been inside, the 8 people of Biosphere 2 in Arizona have been the subject of much speculation and even controversy. What is Biosphere 2, and who are these people? Why are they doing what they are doing? And where do they come from? What will become of their research? Indeed, many have asked whether their research is legitimate science. It is difficult to answer these questions, to say whether these are questions to be asked. The answers, quite literally, are sealed inside a 3-acre-sized towering greenhouse in the desert near Oracle, Arizona, a greenhouse called Biosphere 2. Linda Lay, whose progress we have been following, has been inside Biosphere 2 with her 7 colleagues since September 26, 1991. Regardless of the origin and the merit of their work, that they have managed to stay inside for 2 years to launch what is expected to be a 100 years experiment, that they have stayed with their commitment is quite something. So it is, we placed a call recently to Miss Lay on the eve of preparations for emerging. Hello, Linda Lay.
Hi, this is Linda.
Yes, inside Biosphere 2?
That's right, I'm inside the Biosphere.
We spoke about a year ago, sort of halfway through your 2-year experiment, and as you prepare to walk out in September, what are your thoughts about the experiment over the past 2 years now, on a broader sort of philosophical front?
Well, first of all, on the emotional front, I'm very excited about what's happened in the last 2 years. And the reason for that is I think that we've come a long way at creating this, Biosphere 2, as a laboratory for the life sciences. In fact, I think we're there. I think we have our laboratory. And we have a tremendous potential now for moving the field of global ecology into an experimental science, whereas previously it was descriptive and previously it was theoretical. Now we have actually a laboratory where we can do experiments on what is happening in a global system.
So you feel essentially then that your mission has been successful?
I think so on many levels. I think it's been successful in that we've stuck through the 2 years, and we've had some rough times this 2 years. But we've all come through it in a very healthy condition. We've grown about 80% of our own food, which in light of the lack of light over the last 2 years has been remarkable. And we have really begun some good work on looking at the global carbon cycle inside of Biosphere 2, and also looking at the atmosphere and what happens to an atmosphere as you start to manage all of the life systems within the small system of the biosphere.
According to Lay, the original mission of Biosphere 2 was to create a long-term, ongoing laboratory to study Earth and all its natural systems. It was thought that conducting such a study would be easier done on a small scale, using a sort of miniature Earth.
If we want to look at our impact on, for instance, cutting and burning the tropical rainforest, it's a very difficult mission because Biosphere 1, the Earth, is so big. We can do that in Biosphere 2 if we decide to do that. We can, and in Biosphere 2, what we do is we make some of the biomes go dormant. We cut off the rain. We might cut the grasses in the savanna. And we can very carefully measure the impact of that on the atmosphere and on the total system because it's a small system which replicates the Earth.
Studying Earth in this way for scientific purposes is not only understandable, it is laudable. However, it is here some of the controversy enters. In one now famous article written in April of 1991, the Village Voice suggested that members of Biosphere 2, indeed the whole project itself, had emerged from a cult movement headed by one John P. Allen, known for his apocalyptic view of the human race and its future on the planet. It is known that most of the money put up to construct Biosphere 2 came from millionaire Edward Bass, a follower of John Allen's movement. The Village Voice and other publications since suggested that Biosphere 2 was really testing the possibility of constructing a sort of Noah's Ark for deep space travel. Few will comment directly on this. Lay herself will focus only on the Earth-based benefits of their study. During the 2 years now nearly complete, there were several lapses of scientific procedure, lapses observers felt compromised the results of the experiment as a whole. The most notable episode was the one reported losing oxygen inside the dome and how the biospherans replaced the lost oxygen with oxygen pumped in from outside. Lay not only acknowledges air was brought in, she says this loss and replacement formed a key element in the overall experiment.
Because the oxygen was going down, and it was going down to the limit that we thought that human beings should be in here with low oxygen, we decided rather than take the people out to put more oxygen in. Now, what we could do by adding more oxygen is we could very carefully measure the amount of oxygen coming in, which in fact does not at all dilute any of the original objectives of the project. In fact, it gives us an opportunity that we never in the world thought we would have, and it was fantastic. So, no, that didn't dilute any of the scientific credibility because of the measurability of the oxygen coming in. And then, in fact, it really increased our scientific mission by giving us an unexpected occurrence to study.
To decide which species of plants to bring in, Lay says they consulted with many botanists. Nevertheless, this did leave them in the role of creator.
That's right. They're here because we've decided they should be here. And, in fact, that's exactly what we've done on the Earth, isn't it? Is that we've taken so many things away. We've taken away so many different pieces of the biosphere, of the biomes of the biosphere, but we've done it without deciding that it's okay to take them away. We've just done it helter-skelter in Biosphere 1.
In the end now, as it is with endings, Lay ponders the meaning and whether she would do it all again.
I can say that it's been, well, for me, it's certainly been stressful. And it's been 2 years under glass, separated from a whole lot of other friends and family, and that's very difficult, although I do have a lot of interaction with people over communication systems on computers and telephones and video systems. A lot of people come to visit at the window, and I get to visit with them. So that's taken a little bit of the stress of what really is a remote situation away. It's been stressful from, I think, the point of view of a lot of physical labor, a tremendous amount of physical labor to keep the biosphere operating, and particularly in the first year when we were put in and really doing a big shakedown year. A lot of the systems weren't exactly the way we wanted them, so we spent a lot of time improving systems on the inside. So it was physically exhausting. It was very tiring. So I'd say it's been a very stressful 2 years.
And are you speaking pretty much for the others, too? Has there been stress or have some of the others had an easier time of it and perhaps new relationships begun?
Well, I think that pretty much everybody would agree that it's been a stressful time. And I think that the friendships we've made in here are going to stay forever. There's no doubt about that.
I would imagine so, yes. How much have you been aware of the outside world? You spoke of the window that people can visit through. You can see through the video connections and the computer connections, and certainly this telephone as an example. Have you been aware, following all of the events on Biosphere 1?
I've been following some of them, and other people inside of the biosphere here with me have been following the news more closely than I have. We have televisions. We have radio. We don't get a lot of channels inside here, but we get some. We get faxes from people telling us what's happening. And again, I can tune in to a lot of news reports over my computer through telecommunication systems.
So we don't need to hear or tell you that there's been a new president elected and this is things like that, right?
You know, Bruce, we all voted in that election. So, and we were here watching it on TV, watching the results of that election on television.
Very good.
So we're keeping up on that. We kept up on the fall of the Russian Empire. We're keeping up on what's happening all over the world. And ready to jump back in with both feet. It's a very different world than the one we left.
Linda Lay, Director of Terrestrial Ecosystems in Biosphere 2, an enclosed 3.1-acre, $150 million towering greenhouse located in the foothills of the Catalina Mountains, about 40 miles north of Tucson, Arizona. The 8 residents of the dome will be emerging September 26th, with a new team ready to enter shortly to continue an experiment intended to last 100 years. In the end, perhaps what will emerge will be a better understanding of how to save Earth, or maybe how not to save it. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show, a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Thanks to Kathy Ray for additional research on Biosphere 2. Thanks also to James Ormond, who helped out on today's broadcast. Hello to new friends to The Environment Show listening on WNED in Buffalo, New York. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 188. That's 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 188. The Environment Show, a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.